The anarchist viewpoint is less easily defined. In any case, the loose term anarchist is used to cover a multitude of people of very varying opinions. The huge block of unions making up the CNT, Confederación Nacional de Trabajadores, with round about 2 million members in all, had for its political organ the FAI, Federación Anarquista Ibérica, an actual anarchist organization. But even the members of the FAI, though always tinged, as perhaps most Spaniards are, with the anarchist philosophy, were not necessarily anarchists in the purest sense, especially since the beginning of the war they had moved more in the direction of ordinary socialism, because circumstances had forced them to take part in centralized administration, and even to break all their principles by entering the government. Nevertheless, they differed fundamentally from the communists in so much that, like the PUM, they aimed at workers' control and not a parliamentary democracy. They accepted the PUM slogan, "The war and the revolution are inseparable," though they were less dogmatic about it. Roughly speaking, the CNT-FAI stood for 1. Direct control over industry by the workers engaged in each industry, e.g. transport, the textile factories, etc. 2. Government by local committees and resistance to all forms of centralized authoritarianism. 3. Uncompromising hostility to the bourgeoisie and the church. The last point, though the least precise, was the most important. The anarchists were the opposite of the majority of so-called revolutionaries, in so much that though their principles were rather vague, their hatred of privilege and injustice were perfectly genuine. Philosophically, communism and anarchism are poles apart. Practically, i.e. in the form of society aimed at, the difference is mainly one of emphasis, but it is quite irreconcilable. The communist's emphasis is always on centralism and efficiency, the anarchists on liberty and equality. Anarchism is deeply rooted in Spain and is likely to outlive communism when the Russian influence is withdrawn. During the first 2 months of the war, it was the anarchists more than anyone else who had saved the situation. And much later than this, the anarchist militia, in spite of their indiscipline, were notoriously the best fighters among the purely Spanish forces. From about February 1937 onwards, the anarchists and the PUM could to some extent be lumped together. If the anarchists, the PUM, and the left wing of the socialists had had the sense to combine at the start and press a realistic policy, the history of the war might have been different. But in the early period, when the revolutionary parties seemed to have the game in their hands, this was impossible. Between the anarchists and the socialists, there were ancient jealousies. The PUM, as Marxists, were sceptical of anarchism, while from the anarchist standpoint, the Trotskyism of the PUM was not much preferable to the Stalinism of the communists. Nevertheless, the communist tactics tended to drive the two parties together. When the PUM joined in the disastrous fighting in Barcelona in May, it was mainly from an instinct to stand by the CNT. And later, when the PUM was suppressed, the anarchists were the only people who dared to raise a voice in its defence. So, roughly speaking, the alignment of forces was this. On the one side, the CNT-FAI, the PUM, and a section of the socialists standing for workers' control. On the other side, the right-wing socialists, liberals, and communists standing for centralised government and a militarized army. It's easy to see why at this time I preferred the communist viewpoint to that of the PUM. The communists had a definite practical policy, an obviously better policy from the point of view of the common sense which looks only a few months ahead. And certainly the day-to-day policy of the PUM, their propaganda and so forth, was unspeakably bad. It must have been so, or they would have been able to attract a bigger mass following. What clinched everything was that the communists, so it seemed to me, were getting on with the war while we and the anarchists were standing still. This was the general feeling at the time. The communists had gained power and a vast increase of membership, partly by appealing to the middle classes against the revolutionaries, but partly also because they were the only people who looked capable of winning the war. The Russian arms and the magnificent defense of Madrid by troops mainly under communist control had made the communists the heroes of Spain. As someone put it, every Russian aeroplane that flew over our heads was communist propaganda. The revolutionary purism of the PUM, though I saw its logic, seemed to me rather futile. After all, the one thing that mattered was to win the war. Meanwhile, there was the diabolical inter-party feud that was going on in the newspapers, in pamphlets, on posters, in books, everywhere. At this time, the newspapers I saw most often were the PUM papers, La Batalla and Adelante, and their ceaseless carping against the counter-revolutionary PSUC struck me as priggish and tiresome. Later, when I studied the PSUC and communist press more closely, I realized that the PUM were almost blameless compared with their adversaries. Apart from anything else, they had much smaller opportunities. Unlike the communists, they had no footing in any press outside their own country. And inside Spain, they were at an immense disadvantage because the press censorship was mainly under communist control, which meant that the PUM papers were liable to be suppressed or fined if they said anything damaging. It is also fair to the PUM to say that though they might preach endless sermons on revolution and quote Lenin ad nauseam, they did not usually indulge in personal libel. Also, they kept their polemics mainly to newspaper articles, their large coloured posters designed for a wider public. Posters are important in Spain with its large illiterate population. Did not attack rival parties, but were simply anti-fascist or abstractly revolutionary. So were the songs the militiamen sang. The communist attacks were quite a different matter. I shall have to deal with some of these later in this book. Here, I can give only a brief indication of the communist line of attack. On the surface, the quarrel between the communists and the PUM was one of tactics. The PUM was for immediate revolution, the communists not. So far, so good. There was much to be said on both sides. Further, the communists contended that the PUM propaganda divided and weakened the government forces and thus endangered the war. Again, though finally I do not agree, a good case could be made out for this. But here the peculiarity of communist tactics came in. Tentatively at first, then more loudly, they began to assert that the PUM was splitting the government forces, not by bad judgment, but by deliberate design. The PUM was declared to be no more than a gang of disguised fascists in the pay of Franco and Hitler who were pressing a pseudo-revolutionary policy as a way of aiding the fascist cause. The PUM was a Trotskyist organization and Franco's Fifth Column. This implied that scores of thousands of working-class people, including 8 or 10,000 soldiers who were freezing in the front-line trenches, and hundreds of foreigners who had come to Spain to fight against fascism, often sacrificing their livelihood and their nationality by doing so, were simply traitors in the pay of the enemy. And this story was spread all over Spain by means of posters, etc., and repeated over and over in the communist and pro-communist press of the whole world. I could fill half a dozen books with quotations if I chose to collect them. This, then, was what they were saying about us. We were Trotskyists, fascists, traitors, murderers, cowards, spies, and so forth. I admit it was not pleasant, especially when one thought of some of the people who were responsible for it. It is not a nice thing to see a Spanish boy of 15 carried down the line on a stretcher, with a dazed white face looking out from among the blankets, and to think of the sleek persons in London and Paris who are writing pamphlets to prove that this boy is a fascist in disguise. One of the most horrible features of war is that all the war propaganda, all the screaming and lies and hatred, comes invariably from people who are not fighting. The PSUC militiamen, whom I knew in the line, the communists from the International Brigade, whom I met from time to time, never called me a Trotskyist or a traitor. They left that kind of thing to the journalists in the rear. The people who wrote pamphlets against us and vilified us in the newspapers all remained safe at home, or at the worst in the newspaper offices of Valencia, hundreds of miles from the bullets and the mud. And apart from the libels of the inter-party feud, all the usual war stuff, the tub-thumping, the heroics, the vilification of the enemy, All these were done, as usual, by people who were not fighting and who in many cases would have run 100 miles sooner than fight. One of the dreariest effects of this war has been to teach me that the left-wing press is every bit as spurious and dishonest as that of the right. I should like to make an exception to the Manchester Guardian. In connection with this book, I have had to go through the files of a good many English papers. Of our larger papers, the Manchester Guardian is the only one that leaves me with an increased respect for its honesty. I do earnestly feel that on our side, the government side, this war was different from ordinary imperialistic wars. But from the nature of the war propaganda, you would never have guessed it. The fighting had barely started when the newspapers of the right and left dived simultaneously into the same cesspool of abuse. We all remember the Daily Mail's poster, "Reds crucify nuns," while to the Daily Worker, Franco's Foreign Legion was composed of murderers, white slavers, dope fiends, and the offal of every European country. As late as October 1937, the New Statesman was treating us to tales of fascist barricades made of the bodies of living children, a most unhandy thing to make barricades with. And Mr. Arthur Bryant was declaring that the sawing off of a conservative tradesman's legs was a commonplace in loyalist Spain. The people who write that kind of stuff never fight. Possibly they believe that to write is a substitute for fighting. It's the same in all wars. The soldiers do the fighting, the journalists do the shouting. And no true patriot ever gets near a trench except on the briefest of propaganda tours. Sometimes it's a comfort to me to think that the aeroplane is altering the conditions of war. Perhaps when the next great war comes, we may see that sight unprecedented in all history. A jingo with a bullet hole in him. As far as the journalistic part of it went, this war was a racket like all other wars. But there was this difference, that whereas the journalists usually reserve their most murderous invective for the enemy, in this case, as time went on, the communists and the poom came to write more bitterly about one another than about the fascists. Nevertheless, at the time, I could not bring myself to take it very seriously. The inter-party feud was annoying and even disgusting, but it appeared to me as a domestic squabble. I didn't really believe that it would alter anything, or that there was any really irreconcilable difference of policy. I grasped that the communists and liberals had set their faces against allowing the revolution to go forward. I did not grasp that they might be capable of swinging it back. There was a good reason for this. All this time I was at the front, and at the front the social and political atmosphere did not change. I had left Barcelona in early January, and I did not go on leave till late April. And all this time, indeed till later, in the strip of Aragon controlled by anarchist and poom troops, the same conditions persisted, at least outwardly. The revolutionary atmosphere remained as I had first known it. General and private, peasant and militiamen still met as equals. Everyone drew the same pay, wore the same clothes, ate the same food, and called everyone else thou and comrade. There was no boss class, no menial class, no beggars, no prostitutes, no lawyers, no priests, no boot-licking, no cap-touching. I was breathing the air of equality, and I was simple enough to imagine that it existed all over Spain. I did not realize that more or less by chance I was isolated among the most revolutionary section of the Spanish working class. So, when my more politically educated comrades told me that one could not take a purely military attitude towards the war, and that the choice lay between revolution and fascism, I was inclined to laugh at them. On the whole, I accepted the communist viewpoint, which boiled down to saying we can't talk of revolution till we've won the war, and not the poom viewpoint, which boiled down to saying we must go forward or we shall go back. When later on I decided that the poom were right, or at any rate righter than the communists, it was not altogether upon a point of theory. On paper, the communist case was a good one. The trouble was that their actual behaviour made it difficult to believe that they were advancing it in good faith. The often repeated slogan, "the war first and the revolution afterwards," though devoutly believed in by the average PSUC militiaman, who honestly thought that the revolution could continue when the war had been won, was eyewash. The thing for which the communists were working was not to postpone the Spanish Revolution till a more suitable time, but to make sure that it never happened. This became more and more obvious as time went on, as power was twisted more and more out of working-class hands, and as more and more revolutionaries of every shade were flung into jail. Every move was made in the name of military necessity, because this pretext was, so to speak, ready-made. But the effect was to drive the workers back from an advantageous position and into a position in which, when the war was over, they would find it impossible to resist the reintroduction of capitalism. Please notice that I'm saying nothing against the rank-and-file communist, least of all against the thousands of communists who died heroically round Madrid, but those were not the men who were directing party policy. As for the people higher up, it is inconceivable that they were not acting with their eyes open. But finally, the war was worth winning, even if the revolution was lost. And in the end, I came to doubt whether, in the long run, the communist policy made for victory. Very few people seem to have reflected that a different policy might be appropriate at different periods of the war. The anarchists probably saved the situation in the first 2 months, but they were incapable of organizing resistance beyond a certain point. The communists probably saved the situation in October to December. But to win the war outright was a different matter. In England, the communist war policy has been accepted without question, because very few criticisms of it have been allowed to get into print, and because its general line, "do away with revolutionary chaos, speed up production, militarize the army," sounds realistic and efficient. It's worth pointing out its inherent weakness. In order to check every revolutionary tendency and make the war as much like an ordinary war as possible, it became necessary to throw away the strategic opportunities that actually existed. I've described how we were armed, or not armed, on the Aragon front. There is very little doubt that arms were deliberately withheld lest too many of them should get into the hands of the anarchists, who would afterwards use them for a revolutionary purpose. Consequently, the big Aragon offensive, which would have made Franco draw back from Bilbao and possibly from Madrid, never happened. But this was comparatively a small matter. What was more important was that once the war had been narrowed down to a war for democracy, it became impossible to make any large-scale appeal for working-class aid abroad. If we face facts, we must admit that the working class of the world has regarded the Spanish War with detachment. Tens of thousands of individuals came to fight, but the tens of millions behind them remained apathetic. During the first year of the war, the entire British public is thought to have subscribed to various Aid Spain funds, about £250,000, probably less than half of what they spend in a single week on going to the pictures. The way in which the working class in the democratic countries could really have helped her Spanish comrades was by industrial action, strikes and boycotts. No such thing ever even began to happen. The labour and communist leaders everywhere declared that it was unthinkable. And no doubt they were right, so long as they were also shouting at the tops of their voices that Red Spain was not red. Since 1914-1918, war for democracy has had a sinister sound. For years past, the communists themselves had been teaching the militant workers in all countries that democracy was a polite name for capitalism. To say first democracy is a swindle and then fight for democracy is not good tactics. If, with the huge prestige of Soviet Russia behind them, they had appealed to the workers of the world in the name not of democratic Spain, but of revolutionary Spain, it is hard to believe that they would not have got a response. But what was most important of all, with the non-revolutionary policy, it was difficult, if not impossible, to strike at Franco's rear. By the summer of 1937, Franco was controlling a larger population than the government, much larger if one counts in the colonies, with about the same number of troops. As everyone knows, with a hostile population at your back, it is impossible to keep an army in the field without an equally large army to guard your communications, suppress sabotage, etc. Obviously, therefore, there was no real popular movement in Franco's rear. It was inconceivable that the people in his territory, at any rate the town workers and the poorer peasants, liked or wanted Franco. But with every swing to the right, the government's superiority became less apparent. What clinches everything is the case of Morocco. Why was there no rising in Morocco? Franco was trying to set up an infamous dictatorship, and the Moors actually preferred him to the Popular Front government. The palpable truth is that no attempt was made to foment a rising in Morocco, because to do so would have meant putting a revolutionary construction on the war. The first necessity to convince the Moors of the government's good faith would have been to proclaim Morocco liberated. And we can imagine how pleased the French would have been by that. The best strategic opportunity of the war was flung away in the vain hope of placating French and British capitalism. The whole tendency of the communist policy was to reduce the war to an ordinary non-revolutionary war in which the government was heavily handicapped. For a war of that kind has got to be won by mechanical means, i.e. ultimately by limitless supplies of weapons. And the government's chief donor of weapons, the USSR, was at a great disadvantage geographically compared with Italy and Germany. Perhaps the Poom and anarchist slogan, "The war and the revolution are inseparable," was less visionary than it sounds. I've given my reasons for thinking that the communist anti-revolutionary policy was mistaken, but so far as its effect upon the war goes, I do not hope that my judgment is right. 1,000 times I hope that it is wrong. I would wish to see this war won by any means whatever. And, of course, we cannot tell yet what may happen. The government may swing to the left again. The Moors may revolt of their own accord. England may decide to buy Italy out. The war may be won by straightforward military means. There's no knowing. I let the above opinion stand, and time will show how far I'm right or wrong. But in February 1937, I did not see things quite in this light. I was sick of the inaction on the Aragon front, and chiefly conscious that I had not done my fair share of the fighting. I used to think of the recruiting poster in Barcelona, which demanded accusingly of passers-by, "What have you done for democracy?" and feel that I could only answer, "I have drawn my rations." When I joined the militia, I had promised myself to kill one fascist. After all, if each of us killed one, they would soon be extinct. And I had killed nobody yet, had hardly had the chance to do so. And of course I wanted to go to Madrid. Everyone in the army, whatever his political opinions, always wanted to go to Madrid. This would probably mean exchanging into the international column, for the Poom had now very few troops at Madrid, and the anarchists not so many as formerly. For the present, of course, one had to stay in the line. But I told everyone that when we went on leave, I should, if possible, exchange into the international column, which meant putting myself under communist control. Various people tried to dissuade me, but no one attempted to interfere. It's fair to say that there was very little heresy hunting in the Poom. Perhaps not enough, considering their special circumstances. Short of being a pro-fascist, no one was penalised for holding the wrong political opinions. I spent much of my time in the militia in bitterly criticising the Poom line, but I never got into trouble for it. There was not even any pressure upon one to become a political member of the party, though I think the majority of the militiamen did so. I myself never joined the party, for which afterwards, when the Poom was suppressed, I was rather sorry. Chapter 6. Meanwhile, the daily, more particularly nightly round, the common task, sentry go, patrols, digging, mud, rain, shrieking winds, and occasional snow. It was not till well into April that the nights grew noticeably warmer. Up here on the plateau, the March days were mostly like an English March, with bright blue skies and nagging winds. The winter barley was a foot high. Crimson buds were forming on the cherry trees. The line here ran through deserted orchards and vegetable gardens. And if you searched the ditches, you could find violets and a kind of wild hyacinth, like a poor specimen of a bluebell. Immediately behind the line, there ran a wonderful green, bubbling stream, the first transparent water I'd seen since coming to the front. One day I set my teeth and crawled into the river to have my first bath in 6 weeks. It was what you might call a brief bath, for the water was mainly snow water, and not much above freezing point. Meanwhile, nothing happened. Nothing ever happened. The English had got into the habit of saying that this wasn't a war, it was a bloody pantomime. We were hardly under direct fire from the fascists. The only danger was from stray bullets, which, as the lines curved forward on either side, came from several directions. All the casualties at this time were from strays. Arthur Clinton got a mysterious bullet that smashed his left shoulder and disabled his arm. Permanently, I'm afraid. There was a little shell fire, but it was extraordinarily ineffectual. The scream and crash of the shells was actually looked upon as a mild diversion. The fascists never dropped their shells on our parapet. A few hundred yards behind us, there was a country house called La Granja, with big farm buildings, which was used as a store, headquarters and cookhouse for this sector of the line. It was this that the fascist gunners were trying for, but they were 5 or 6 kilometres away, and they never aimed well enough to do more than smash the windows and chip the walls. You were only in danger if you happened to be coming up the road when the firing started and the shells plunged into the fields on either side of you. One learned almost immediately the mysterious art of knowing by the sound of a shell how close it will fall. The shells the fascists were firing at this period were wretchedly bad. Although they were 150 millimetre, they only made a crater about 6 feet wide by 4 deep, and at least 1 in 4 failed to explode. There were the usual romantic tales of sabotage in the fascist factories, and unexploded shells in which, instead of the charge, there was found a scrap of paper saying Red Front, but I never saw one. The truth was that the shells were hopelessly old. Someone picked up a brass fuse cap stamped with the date, and it was 1917. The fascist guns were of the same make and calibre as our own, and the unexploded shells were often reconditioned and fired back. There was said to be one old shell with a nickname of its own which travelled daily to and fro, never exploding. At night, small patrols used to be sent into no man's land to lie in ditches near the fascist lines and listen for sounds, bugle calls, motor horns and so forth, that indicated activity in Huesca. There was a constant come and go of fascist troops, and the numbers could be checked to some extent from listeners' reports. We always had special orders to report the ringing of church bells. It seemed that the fascists always heard mass before going into action. In among the fields and orchards, there were deserted, mud-walled huts, which it was safe to explore with a lighted match when you had plugged up the windows. Sometimes you came on valuable pieces of loot, such as a hatchet or a fascist water bottle, better than ours and greatly sought after. You could explore in the daytime as well, but mostly it had to be done crawling on all fours. It was queer to creep about in those empty, fertile fields where everything had been arrested just at the harvest moment. Last year's crops had never been touched. The unpruned vines were snaking across the ground. The cobs on the standing maize had gone as hard as stone. The mangels and sugar beets were hypertrophied into huge wooden lumps. How the peasants must have cursed both armies. Sometimes parties of men went spud-gathering in no man's land. About a mile to the right of us, where the lines were closer together, there was a patch of potatoes that was frequented both by the fascists and ourselves. We went there in the daytime, they only at night, as it was commanded by our machine guns. One night, to our annoyance, they turned out en masse and cleared up the whole patch. We discovered another patch, farther on, where there was practically no cover and you had to lift the potatoes lying on your belly. a fatiguing job. If their machine gunners spotted you, you had to flatten yourself out like a rat when it squirms under a door, with the bullets cutting up the clods a few yards behind you. It seemed worth it at the time. Potatoes were getting very scarce. If you got a sack full, you could take them down to the cookhouse and swap them for a water bottle full of coffee. And still nothing happened. Nothing ever looked like happening. When are we going to attack? Why don't we attack? Were the questions you heard night and day from Spaniard and Englishman alike. When you think what fighting means, it's queer that soldiers want to fight. And yet undoubtedly they do. In stationary warfare, there are three things that all soldiers long for. A battle, more cigarettes, and a week's leave. We were somewhat better armed now than before. Each man had 150 rounds of ammunition instead of 50, and by degrees we were being issued with bayonets, steel helmets, and a few bombs. There were constant rumours of forthcoming battles, which I have since thought were deliberately circulated to keep up the spirits of the troops. It didn't need much military knowledge to see that there would be no major action on this side of Huesca, at any rate for the time being. The strategic point was the road to Jaca, over on the other side. Later, when the anarchists made their attacks on the Jaca Road, our job was to make holding attacks and force the fascists to divert troops from the other side. During all this time, about 6 weeks, there was only one action on our part of the front. This was when our shock troopers attacked the Manicomio, a disused lunatic asylum which the fascists had converted into a fortress. There were several hundred refugee Germans serving with the PUM. They were organised in a special battalion, and from a military point of view, they were on quite a different level from the rest of the militia. Indeed, were more like soldiers than anyone I saw in Spain, except the assault guards and some of the international column. The attack was mucked up as usual. How many operations in this war on the government side were not mucked up, I wonder? The shock troops took the Manicomio by storm, but the troops, of which I forget which militia, who were to support them by seizing the neighbouring hill that commanded the Manicomio, were badly let down. The captain who led them was one of those regular army officers of doubtful loyalty whom the government persisted in employing. Either from fright or treachery, he warned the fascists by flinging a bomb when they were 200 yards away. I'm glad to say that his men shot him dead on the spot. But the surprise attack was no surprise, and the militiamen were mown down by heavy fire and driven off the hill, and at nightfall the shock troops had to abandon the Manicomio. Through the night the ambulances filed down the abominable road to Sietamo, killing the badly wounded with their joltings. All of us were lousy by this time. Though still cold, it was warm enough for that. I've had a big experience of body vermin of various kinds, and for sheer beastliness, the louse beats everything I've encountered. Other insects, mosquitoes, for instance, make you suffer more, but at least they aren't resident vermin. The human louse somewhat resembles a tiny lobster, and he lives chiefly in your trousers. Short of burning all your clothes, there is no known way of getting rid of him. Down the seams of your trousers he lays his glittering white eggs, like tiny grains of rice, which hatch out and breed families of their own at horrible speed. I think the pacifists might find it helpful to illustrate their pamphlets with enlarged photographs of lice. Glory of war, indeed. In war, all soldiers are lousy, at least when it's warm enough. The men who fought at Verdun, at Waterloo, at Flodden, at Senlac, every one of them had lice crawling over his testicles. We kept the brutes down to some extent by burning out the eggs and by bathing as often as we could face it. Nothing short of lice could have driven me into that ice-cold river. Everything was running short. Boots, clothes, tobacco, soap, candles, matches, olive oil. Our uniforms were dropping to pieces, and many of the men had no boots, only rope-soled sandals. You came on piles of worn-out boots everywhere. Once we kept a dugout fire burning for 2 days, mainly with boots, which are not bad fuel. By this time my wife was in Barcelona, and used to send me tea, chocolate, and even cigars when such things were procurable. But even in Barcelona everything was running short, especially tobacco. The tea was a godsend, though we had no milk and seldom any sugar. Parcels were constantly being sent from England to men in the contingent, but they never arrived. Food, clothes, cigarettes, Everything was either refused by the post office or seized in France. Curiously enough, the only firm that succeeded in sending packets of tea, even on one memorable occasion a tin of biscuits to my wife, was the Army and Navy stores. Poor old Army and Navy. They did their duty nobly, but perhaps they might have felt happier if the stuff had been going to Franco's side of the barricade. The shortage of tobacco was the worst of all. At the beginning, we had been issued with a packet of cigarettes a day. Then it got down to 8 cigarettes a day, then to 5. Finally, there were 10 deadly days when there was no issue of tobacco at all. For the first time in Spain, I saw something that you see every day in London. People picking up fag ends. Towards the end of March, I got a poisoned hand that had to be lanced and put in a sling. I had to go into hospital, but it was not worth sending me to see a Tamo for such a petty injury. So I stayed in the so-called hospital at Montfleurite, which was merely a casualty clearing station. I was there 10 days, part of the time in bed. The practicantes, hospital assistants, stole practically every valuable object I possessed, including my camera and all my photographs. At the front, everyone stole. It was the inevitable effect of shortage. But the hospital people were always the worst. Later, in the hospital of Barcelona, an American who had come to join the international column on a ship that was torpedoed by an Italian submarine told me how he was carried ashore wounded and how, even as they lifted him into the ambulance, the stretcher-bearers pinched his wristwatch. While my arm was in the sling, I spent several blissful days wandering about the countryside. Montfleurite was the usual huddle of mud and stone houses, with narrow, tortuous alleys that had been churned by lorries till they looked like the craters of the moon. The church had been badly knocked about, but was used as a military store. In the whole neighbourhood, there were only 2 farmhouses of any size, Torre Lorenzo and Torre Fabian, and only 2 really large buildings, obviously the houses of the landowners who had once lorded it over the countryside. You could see their wealth reflected in the miserable huts of the peasants. Just behind the river, close to the front line, there was an enormous flour mill with a country house attached to it. It seemed shameful to see the huge, costly machine rusting useless and the wooden flour chutes torn down for firewood. Later on, to get firewood for the troops farther back, parties of men were sent in lorries to wreck the place systematically. They used to smash the floorboards of a room by bursting a hand grenade in it. La Granja, our store and cookhouse, had possibly at one time been a convent. It had huge courtyards and outhouses, covering an acre or more, with stabling for 30 or 40 horses. The country houses in that part of Spain are of no interest architecturally, but their farm buildings, of lime-washed stone with round arches and magnificent roof beams, are noble places, built on a plan that has probably not altered for centuries. Sometimes it gave you a sneaking sympathy with the fascist ex-owners to see the way the militia treated the buildings they'd seized. In La Granja, every room that was not in use had been turned into a latrine, a frightful shambles of smashed furniture and excrement. The little church that adjoined it, its walls perforated by shell holes, had its floor inches deep in dung. In the great courtyard, where the cooks ladled out the rations, the litter of rusty tins, mud, mule dung, and decaying food was revolting. It gave point to the old army song, "There are rats, rats, rats as big as cats in the quartermaster's store." The ones at La Granja itself really were as big as cats, or nearly, great bloated brutes that waddled over the beds of muck, too impudent even to run away unless you shot at them. Spring was really here at last. The blue in the sky was softer, the air grew suddenly balmy, the frogs were mating noisily in the ditches. Round the drinking pool that served for the village mules, I found exquisite green frogs the size of a penny, so brilliant that the young grass looked dull beside them. Peasant lads went out with buckets hunting for snails, which they roasted alive on sheets of tin. As soon as the weather improved, the peasants had turned out for the spring ploughing. It's typical of the utter vagueness in which the Spanish agrarian revolution is wrapped that I couldn't even discover for certain whether the land here was collectivised or whether the peasants had simply divided it up among themselves. I fancy that in theory it was collectivised, this being Poom and anarchist territory. At any rate, the landowners were gone, the fields were being cultivated, and the people seemed satisfied. The friendliness of the peasants towards ourselves never ceased to astonish me. To some of the older ones, the war must have seemed meaningless. Visibly it produced a shortage of everything and a dismal life for everybody, and at the best of times peasants hate having troops quartered upon them. Yet they were invariably friendly. I suppose reflecting that, however intolerable we might be in other ways, we did stand between them and their one-time landlords. Civil war is a queer thing. Huesca was not 5 miles away. It was these people's market town. All of them had relatives there. Every week of their lives they had gone there to sell their poultry and vegetables. And now, for 8 months, an impenetrable barrier of barbed wire and machine guns had lain between. Occasionally it slipped their memory. Once I was talking to an old woman who was carrying one of those tiny iron lamps in which the Spaniards burn olive oil. "Where can I buy a lamp like that?" I said. "In Huesca," she said, without thinking, and then we both laughed. The village girls were splendid, vivid creatures with coal-black hair, a swinging walk, and a straightforward man-to-man demeanour, which was probably a by-product of the revolution. Men in ragged blue shirts and black corduroy breeches, with broad-brimmed straw hats, were ploughing the fields behind teams of mules with rhythmically flopping ears. Their ploughs were wretched things, only stirring the soil, not cutting anything we should regard as a furrow. All the agricultural implements were pitifully antiquated, everything being governed by the expensiveness of metal. A broken ploughshare, for instance, was patched, and then patched again, till sometimes it was mainly patches. Rakes and pitchforks were made of wood. Spades, among a people who seldom possessed boots, were unknown. They did their digging with a clumsy hoe that looked like those used in India. There was a kind of harrow that took one straight back to the later Stone Age. It was made of boards joined together to about the size of a kitchen table. In the boards, hundreds of holes were mortised, and into each hole was jammed a piece of flint, which had been chipped into shape exactly as men used to chip them 10,000 years ago. I remember my feeling almost of horror when I first came upon one of these things in a derelict hut in no man's land. I had to puzzle over it for a long while before grasping that it was a harrow. It made me sick to think of the work that must go into the making of such a thing, and the poverty that was obliged to use flint in place of steel. I felt more kindly towards industrialism ever since. But in the village there were 2 up-to-date farm tractors, no doubt seized from some big landowner's estate.